This is The Takeaway for Tuesday, June 20th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening. Why would a container ship flying a Philippine flag change course suddenly in the dark early morning hours of June 17th and slam into a U.S. Navy destroyer? It was a mystery then.
I'm not going to speculate what happened, but it will be a full and thorough investigation. But for me to say what happened at 2:20 in the morning yesterday, unknown.
And this event remains just as much a mystery today. It's the voice there of Commander of the U.S. Navy's 7th Fleet, Vice Admiral Joseph Acoin. The USS Fitzgerald suffered 7 fatal uniformed Navy casualties. Pictures of the severe damage have not helped to resolve the many questions surrounding the incident. The American and Japanese governments have launched separate investigations. The container ship was bound for Japan. The U.S. Navy's 7th Fleet plays a significant role in the Pacific, as both China and the Philippines have signaled a more aggressive stance in the region. Reuters reporter Tim Kelly joins us from Tokyo. Tim, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello.
Are the sea lanes in any way crowded between the Philippines and Japan, and in terms of what the 7th Fleet is typically patrolling?
Well, where the incident took place was on the approach to Tokyo Bay. And in Tokyo Bay, you have Tokyo, and also you have the port of Yokohama, which are Japan's 2 biggest container ports. So at any one time, you have around 400 vessels in that small area. So it's one of the busiest waterways in Asia. So it was about 56 miles from the Japanese coast, and it was on its way to Yokosuka, where the vessel is home ported.
And for a container ship to make such an abrupt move, this seems unusual to me. I mean, a container ship would really need a head of steam to even have a chance of ramming a military ship like a destroyer.
Yeah, so it's one of the things that has been noted is the abrupt U-turn that the ACX Crystal, the Philippine ship, made. There's been some discrepancies on the time. So the Philippine ship reported the collision at 2:25 a.m. However, after further investigation, they said that the collision actually happened at 1:30. So there was a 55-minute delay in the ship reporting the collision. So that's one of the areas that they're looking at in the investigation, what happened during that 55 minutes. And within that time frame, this is when the ship was making its, what some say, an erratic movement.
And the crew, how did they keep this ship from sinking? A container ship outweighs a destroyer by a significant amount.
Well, the Filipino ship is about almost 4 times the size of the U.S. destroyer. It caused a lot of damage on the top of the ship, but also it has a bulbous point that protrudes below water and caused a gash below there. So a lot of water rushed into the ship, and then the crew would have had to go into damage control, close down the watertight compartments, and then try and pump the water out. So it was a very close call. I think Admiral Acoin, during his press conference on Sunday, noted that the ship was very close to sinking.
Is this a sign of what the 7th Fleet is going to have to be dealing with in waters that are suddenly very different in terms of sort of strategic tension in the Pacific right now? And we've already had some back and forth between the Trump administration and China and the Trump administration and the Philippines. And does the Philippines even have an explanation of what happened here?
No explanation has come forth from any of the parties involved or investigating. It's still at a very early stage. You know, the 7th Fleet has been based in Japan since World War II, and Yokosuka is the home of the Ronald Reagan, the 7th Fleet's carrier. So they're very used to operating in Japanese waters. And while there have been incidents in the past involving U.S. naval ships striking smaller fishing vessels, this kind of incident is a very rare thing, and it's the first time it's happened in Japanese waters. In fact, you have to go back 50-odd years to find anything that's similar anywhere in the world. So, you know, the 7th Fleet has a lot of attention in Japan, as you noted. Tension within the region is deepening. There's growing tension with China and then North Korea. So the 7th Fleet is playing a very significant role in, if you like, managing those tensions or trying to bolster security in the region, also in concert with the Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Force. And cooperation between the two is increasing. But these kind of incidents, well, I say it's very rare. One of the mysteries of this is how a naval vessel at sea albeit at nighttime, but the skies were clear, the sea was not rough. How can a collision between these two vessels, large vessels, occur in those conditions? That's something that, as yet, we don't know the reason to, and the investigations will have to clear up.
Tim Kelly of Reuters is speaking to us from Tokyo. Thanks so much, Tim.
Thank you.
The crowding in the Pacific sea lanes is nothing like the crowding in the skies over Syria. On Sunday, a U.S. fighter jet shot down a Syrian warplane after it had bombed local ground forces supported by the U.S. in the Raqqa province. Russia, backing the Syrian regime headed by President Bashar al-Assad, are you following this, is a large part of Syria's air force. Syria's planes are all Russian-made. So, the Russian Defense Ministry called the U.S. hit a military aggression, declaring that it would terminate all communications with the U.S. on future airstrikes and adding that all aircraft, including U.S. war jets, would be considered targets from here on out. Dr. Olga Oleker is director of the Russia and Eurasia Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. Welcome, doctor.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
When it became clear that the U.S. and Russia were going to be operating in this very tight space over Syria, really now a year or so ago, a few years ago, wasn't this situation right here that we're experiencing absolutely inevitable?
Look, I think, I don't know that it was. Until very recently, the United States wasn't targeting Syrian military forces. The shooting down of this aircraft and then a little while ago, the strike on the Syrian airbase were actually a shift. The United States had been supporting forces opposed to Assad, but they hadn't themselves been acting against Assad's military.
Although, how do you see that? This is the situation that I have the problem with. I mean, how do you actually support them without fighting the other guys? I mean, if you're going to create a situation where you're assisting an opposition in taking over a regime or causing the downfall of Bashar al-Assad, that requires one set of tactics. If you're basically just enforcing a stalemate with Russia there helping the other side enforce the same stalemate, how can that possibly accomplish anything?
So in theory, Assad isn't the issue for the United States, right? The U.S. narrative is that we're there to fight ISIS, Daesh, whatever you want to call it. Assad's forces, in theory, are also fighting ISIS, Daesh, whatever you want to call it, except that they're also fighting this opposition. We're supporting the opposition, in theory, against ISIS. So as long as kind of we're all, you know, I think the Russian narrative was we're all fighting ISIS, let's all get along and fight ISIS together. And they were hopeful when Donald Trump came into office that that would hold more water and the United States would be willing to cut some sorts of deals with Assad. And what we've gotten instead is the United States that still wants to fight ISIS and strike ISIS targets, but is now also striking Syrian government targets.
So I guess the question here is, who will use this as a pretext to escalate tensions here? Is either the U.S. retaliation against Syrian targets likely to be a Russian pretext, as it seems the defense ministry's response is something like that, or will the Trump administration now use this everything's a target policy of the Russians to be a pretext for also escalating the situation?
So I don't think the Russians actually want to escalate the situation. What they don't want to back off on their support for Assad. It is important to them that they continue to back Assad for a wide range of reasons. So they have to respond somehow to a U.S. strike on a Syrian military target. Unfortunately, the only thing they have at this disposal is shutting down this this hotline for communication, which is actually fairly crucial to avoid escalation. And the last time they did this after the U.S. strike on the Syrian base, it came back on fairly quickly. And really what the Russians want is to cut a deal with the United States over Syria, zones of control, something like that. They want to be solving this together. And I think they're frustrated that that's not working out because the United States has turned its sights, so to speak, on Assad as well as on ISIS in a much more overt way than had been the case in the past with just supporting the opposition.
It seems like time is ticking, really, for the Russians to close this deal. In that, as time goes on, Syria doesn't have any materiel. It doesn't. I mean, it's running out of everything. I mean, almost everything over there that's Syrian is actually Russian with the Syrian flag painted on it. I mean, the Syrian Air Force itself is practically a Russian operation.
Most people have to buy their weapons somewhere, right? We're not all the United States and Russia building a whole army worth of weapons for ourselves. Most of the rest of the world buys our weapons and, you know, some French weapons and some other weapons. So I wouldn't focus on that much. The Russian operation really is a support operation. The opposition, ISIS, et cetera, they are fighting Syria, which is backed by Iran and Russia. They're not fighting Russia directly. But Russian air defenses are there, so the Russians are able to say things like, all of your aircraft will be in our sights. Though I suspect they were in their sights before. I mean,
right.
You monitor everything that goes through your airspace.
And so the question is, who's probing here for a weakness? If, as you say, the Russians are frustrated and want a deal to be negotiated quickly for whatever reason. I mean, my theory doesn't work, but for whatever reason, is the Trump administration likely to exert pressure?
I think the Trump administration has made it clear that it will strike at Syrian military targets under certain circumstances. We can debate where that fits into international law and so on and so forth, but, you know, we have two precedents now. Whether this second one was directed, from above, whether that's part of a real policy or strategy, or whether that was an immediate response to that Syrian aircraft's attack on forces that were aligned with the coalition, I can't judge, right? I don't know the answer to that. But I do caution against assuming that it is part of a clear strategy.
The Trump strategy is clear. Okay, fine. So, which just leads me to my last question, and that is, you know, you speak very articulately about all of this that's going on here, but do you, when you step back from it, consider this to be a sustainable level of disorganization over Syria? Is this more likely to, is there an orderly path out of this, or is some outlier going to basically reset the table?
Look, it's a disaster. It's been a disaster this entire time. It was a disaster before the Russians came in. It became a slightly different disaster when the Russians came in. It's now a new form of disaster with the United States shifting its tactics. I don't see good ways out of it. I think, you know, it's going to continue to be ugly and awful, and people will continue to die. Whether a negotiated solution can make that ugliness slightly less ugly over time. I mean, I think that's what everybody who wants to see resolution is hoping for. But it's tough to see it clearly because people's strategic goals are so confused, and there are so many parties to this fight.
Dr. Olga Oliker is director of the Russia and Eurasia program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. Doctor, thanks so much.
Thank you.
American Otto Warmbier went to North Korea in 2015. Today, he's dead from a catastrophic brain injury that produced a year-long coma, all suffered while he was in a North Korean prison. Sentenced to 15 years hard labor for attempting to take a political poster. Human Rights Watch issued a statement saying Warmbier's death occurred after he was abused in North Korean custody, a reminder of North Korea's pattern of brutalizing and killing anyone to maintain its hold on power. President Trump, in a short statement, expressed anger. Otto's fate deepens my administration's determination to prevent such tragedies from befalling innocent people at the hands of regimes that do not respect the rule of law or basic human decency. John Sifton is Asia Advocacy Director at Human Rights Watch, and he says that ending up like Otto Warmbier is a consequence of daily life that is brutal, frightening, and where imprisonment can happen without warning.
There's no denying that for any North Korean citizen, life in North Korea is a nightmare. Even if you're at the top of the caste system, you live in a state of terror. It's a totalitarian country in which the government controls almost every aspect of human societal life. And if you cross the government, you will be sent to prison, to a work camp, to a prison camp, to a labor camp. And you quite possibly will die in that camp if you don't follow the rules.
Well, if that is the case, I'm surprised that so many more American, that more of them haven't died.
It's very difficult to know what happens, why certain people get arrested. There have been a lot of tourists into North Korea, and many of them come and go. Some of them Americans, some of them Europeans, Asians. But sometimes people get arrested. There are three other American citizens currently imprisoned in North Korea right now. it's not clear what happened, why certain people are arrested and others aren't. It can be on suspicion of spying, or it can be for some trifle, which it appears to have been in this case.
And when you say trifle, I mean, it seems as though this young man was just taking a poster, possibly for a souvenir. I mean, I'm speculating, of course, but to have this happen, I mean, catastrophic brain injury is what was the diagnosis in the end. And he was in that condition when he came out of the country.
Yeah, and we still don't know exactly what happened. But what I will tell you is that we know that North Koreans are routinely imprisoned for trifles all the time. Economic crimes, as innocent as just taking part in private enterprise, buying and selling items outside of the state-run economic system, can get you into prison. You can bribe your way out. You can trade sexual favors. You can do a lot of things to avoid it. But the simple fact is you can go to prison for much less than stealing a poster. You can go to prison for refusing to obey a police officer or a teacher or your boss. So it's a very brutal place. It is a totalitarian regime.
Obviously, we must be concerned with the human rights of all, not simply American young men who have this experience, and their family in Cincinnati is mourning even as we speak. But nevertheless, the ritualized, it seems, play between North Korea and the United States regarding hostages and, you know, tit for tat and diplomatic favors and little changes in policy that result seems to have gone very much awry here.
North Korea has always been a very, very unreliable diplomatic interlocutor, whether it's on nuclear issues, missile technology, or the new issues, which are its human rights record. I mean, believe it or not, North Korea's human rights record was not a subject of the United Nations debates in the Security Council until very recently. For decades, the nuclear issue predominated and upstaged everything else. But more recently, its human rights record has been debated in the Security Council, in the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva, and it has really freaked out the regime. They are more upset in some ways about the attention to their human rights record than to all of the saber rattling about their nuclear program. And that's been seen when the way that they've shown up at the UN and tried to bargain with the United Nations system. And they failed.
Does China have a position on the question of human rights in North Korea? It's certainly a sensitive issue in China when the U.S. attempts to address it.
Yeah, China is in a very difficult situation because it is complicit in North Korea's human rights abuses, because it routinely sends back North Koreans there who try to escape. It also supports North Korea in various ways by being one of its biggest trading – its predominant trading partner. And yet – nobody in Beijing wakes up in the morning and wants North Korea to be what it is. It's a thorn in their side, and they know it, and they probably wish that it could be far less of a problematic child on their border. So they're in a difficult position. I think what's up to the international community now, and this case illustrates the severity of the situation, is how to get China to put more pressure on North Korea so that they have to pay a price when they violate human rights norms, international norms, or, you know, proliferation norms. The price just doesn't seem to be high enough right now. Many countries, not just China, routinely violate the sanctions. It's not just China. Singapore, Nigeria, all these countries are just not paying the price for doing business with North Korea.
Which would be an argument for some kind of U.S. retaliation, whether that's a diplomatic retaliation with all of the countries that you've named, or whether that's something directly retaliating at Kim Jong-un's regime. What would you suggest?
Well, one of the problems with the American international diplomatic and political discourse is that people just view things and you either have diplomacy or you have military action. And that's just not how the world works. The Iran sanctions that led to the proliferation agreement are a good example. You can have sanctions and then you can enforce sanctions. And the dirty little secret with North Korea is that it has a very powerful sanctions regime that is routinely flaunted by countries all over the world, even allies, even members of the UN Security Council. And as with Iran, you can see that if the United States steps up and starts enforcing the sanctions and urging its allies and other actors to enforce the sanctions, it has an effect, because eventually money runs out. There's only so much cash that this regime can create through its illegal schemes and its selling of coal in violation of sanctions. If you tighten up the sanctions, eventually it will have an impact in Pyongyang, and they will say, wow, there's a price to what we're doing. But right now, we're not there yet.
John Sifton is Asia Advocacy Director at Human Rights Watch. Thank you so much, John.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckabee. Fear of walking through a parking lot.
Walking back alone in a parking lot, knowing that people don't think I deserve to be living or be in the United States, is deeply concerning.
The fear of a young Muslim woman walking through a parking lot in America, in this case, California. But her fear is reinforced this week by a 17-year-old girl killed after leaving her mosque in Fairfax, Virginia, very early Sunday morning. She and her friends were having a Ramadan meal before sunrise at a 24-hour IHOP, and at this point, the details are unclear. Officials are waiting on the chief medical examiner's autopsy, but the All Dulles Area Muslim Society has identified the girl as Nabra Hassanan. A 22-year-old man has been charged with murder in the case, calling it road rage, not a hate crime. But to Muslims around the nation on alert during Ramadan, road rage and hate crime may be interchangeable terms. Marguerite Hill is co-director of the Muslim Anti-Racism Collaborative. You just heard her voice there reacting to the Virginia case. For Muslims right now, fear is real.
Our community across the country is shaken. I have a 17-year-old intern, and she takes public transportation also, and she's deeply affected. There's vigils across the country where we have people of all ages crying, thinking about how terrible it is for a life cut so short in such a, you know, horrific way.
And while local authorities have not labeled this a hate crime, they've called it road rage or something like that. You know, this is the kind of disruption that I suspect are the kinds of things that worry you most.
It is. I often worry about road rage. I have a continual fear, especially even taking my daughter out, of worrying about her safety in case someone, they see me particularly as a target and how that can affect her. And so, you know, this is a daily fear that a lot of us have. And especially I live in San Bernardino County, where I've had a friend who, she was threatened with a knife shortly after the San Bernardino shooting. So it is definitely a real fear that we have. I mean, when there's a protest, you can decide, okay, I'm not going to go in that area that day. But when, you know, you're at some place like the Cheesecake Factory and realize that somebody is offended that I'm breathing in their same space, it is very frightening. You know, walking back alone in a parking lot, knowing that people don't think I deserve to be living or be in the United States, is deeply concerning.
So what's the solution here for these kinds of events, to bring them, to raise their profile and to create a dialogue that would reduce their likelihood of happening in the future?
Well, it is definitely complicated of thinking about ways we can reduce the numbers of hate crimes. One, we have to think about the kind of political rhetoric with our elected officials. There are correlations with that. When we have elected officials that dehumanize communities, they're actually more targeted. The media plays a role into that. So I think that's important. But also for communities, we have to think about safety, different, whether for targeted individuals to think about their own personal safety, but also bystander intervention is important in preventing death. We don't always know what will be the outcome of bystander intervention, but if more of us take a role in being on the lookout for our neighbors or someone in the parking lot to make sure that they're okay, then we can prevent incidents like this from happening.
Marguerite Hill is co-director of the Muslim Anti-Racism Collaborative. She spoke with us from California. Marguerite, thank you so much.
Thank you.
When Boston Mayor Marty Walsh was a young man, he experienced the open racial intolerance in his community as parents confronted police enforcing court-ordered busing to desegregate Boston's public schools. Boston has struggled with the hidden truth of racial intolerance for decades. Truth as when a Fenway Park Red Sox fan yelled racial slurs at a Baltimore Orioles player, Adam Jones, last month. hidden truth as how comedian Michael Che could bury Boston's reputation in humor on Saturday Night Live in this Super Bowl joke.
I just want to relax, turn my brain off, and watch the blackest city in America beat the most racist city I've ever been to.
Mayor Marty Walsh wants to dehumorize this joke about his city and ultimately unmask the people who feel they can shout racial hatred in public without consequences. The mayor is spearheading an initiative in partnership with the Himes Foundation to develop a citywide organized series of events to talk about race with a team of facilitators skilled in these kinds of discussions. He joined us from our partner station WGBH to explain how it will all work.
These dialogues aren't going to be scripted. They're going to be open dialogues, and we're asking companies to have conversations. We're asking churches to have conversations. We're asking neighborhoods to have conversations, because when you think about what's happened in the country, whether it's been the acts of in Ferguson or New York, or what's happened in Fenway Park a couple weeks ago with the Adam Jones situation, or were you hearing other players around different leagues saying that, you know, there's racism and racist remarks all over the place? We need to do better as a society.
How did you react to that baseball story?
It was disappointing, and certainly the next day was as disappointing, if not even more disappointing in some ways, because we had a father there with his son, and one of the people next to him made a racial comment about somebody singing the national anthem, and it was just a really bad situation, and it happens every day in America, and you know, Boston seems to have a spotlight on it more and more when it happens here, but it really does happen other places. And I think that, you know, having these dialogues and having this understanding in different ways will help us heal. I think in order to move beyond a lot of issues, we have to heal. And indirectly in President Obama, when he created My Brother's Keeper, part of that is also around race and racism, what he did there, and dealing with slavery and how do generational African-American people deal with slavery and or not deal with slavery. So there's a very complex thing going on right now in America. And I think even with the feeling in Washington is adding a lot more anxiety to it. And mm-hmm. I think that in Boston, I'm hopeful that we're going to take this dialogue and going to try and lead maybe the rest of the country with it. But it has to happen. You can't ignore it.
No, and you mentioned slavery and you mentioned healing. And I'm glad that you mentioned both of those, because I think there really is healing required from the particular circumstances of American history. And healing from slavery and the Jim Crow period is one narrative. Whites have to heal from the mistakes and the passions that were expressed. I remember when school busing, was imposed on Boston. I was shocked at the intensity. You lived through that, yes?
Yeah, I was young at the time. I was in grammar school, but you know, it affected a lot of people. It still affects people. And that's one of the conversations on race, that, you know, we had white kids and white families that moved out of the city because they didn't want to get their kids bused across the city. You had black families that didn't have the ability to move out of the city that were angry because their kids were bused to another part of the city. And I think at that period in the 70s, the early 70s, mid-70s, we're supposed to just ignore it and hope it goes away. And it really hasn't gone away. And there's still a lot of repercussions of what happened. And I think that that's important. I think I had an opportunity a couple weeks ago to go down to the African American Museum. And I was, you know, you start down the bottom of the museum and you go up, so you start in the 1400s. And you think about the impacts of slavery on people. And, you know, when you think about slavery, and not everyone understands, well, you know, slavery happened, you know, 300 years ago. Why is it still an issue? It happened 200 years ago. Why is it still an issue? It's still an issue because people, it's affected generational families. And I think that I gave the analogy the other day to, you know, as an Irish person, Irish American, you know, the trauma that England put on Ireland for so many years until 1917 when the Easter Rising happened, and people still carry that forward here in Irish culture. They still think about the past. So you do have to deal with the past, and you don't want history to repeat itself. And I think that, you know, yeah, we can accuse each other of whatever and name call, but as a mayor of a city, I know that this is the right way to go, and this is the right thing to do here for our city. I see it with our kids in our schools, and it's about them. It's about not about me, and it's not about the people, the older people today. It's about our future of our city, and the kids are our future of our city. And you're never going to get to closure, but get to an understanding.
Well, it'd be great to get beyond the impulse in America, I think, to joke about these things. Did you recall Michael Che on Saturday Night Live?
Yeah, that was hurtful in a way. You know, as the mayor, obviously, you might say take offense to it. But you know what it does? You know, there's two ways of reacting to that. One is condemning Michael Che and say he's wrong. And the second is embracing it and saying, well, there's a perception here. In a reality, how do you fix it? And I would prefer the second piece of that. And I think that, you know, he was on Saturday Night Live right after that, a couple weeks ago, and he talked about the incident with Adam Jones, and he spoke about 36 people were ejected from the ballpark, and the way they insinuated it was 36 people because of racism. That wasn't the case in the park. But the issue is we have to deal with it. So how do we respond in Boston? The Red Sox has sat down with the NAACP. We're sitting down talking with all the sports teams. We had a meeting a couple weeks ago. We had the Bruins, the Celtics, the Red Sox, the Patriots, and the Revolution in there. So we're responding, rather than reacting in a negative manner, we're responding and going to respond in a positive manner to deal with the issue. And that's what we have. We have to stop knee-jerk reaction. That's what, again, I don't mean to pick on Washington, but everything seems to be a knee-jerk reaction out of Washington lately. Let's take a deep breath and let's deal with the issues in front of us.
What's your metric? What's your sort of thought in your brain? When we've done this for a couple of years, the thing I want to see in Boston is blank.
Healing. I guess that there's more healing and there's a better understanding of race and that, you know, we're a city, a multicultural city in Boston. 28% of our residents are foreign born. 48% of our residents are first generation. So we're a multicultural city here in Boston, as many urban American cities are. It's something I think we're one of the only cities that is looking to tackle this issue and to take this issue on citywide. You know, some of these conversations will be difficult and some of these conversations will be easier. But I think it's very important for us to move forward with these conversations.
Well, Mayor Marty Walsh, have a great summer and thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. Talk to you soon.
For 6 years, rock climber Tommy Caldwell stared at an immense blank rock wall, meticulously planning how he would scale up the Dawn Wall of El Capitan in Yosemite National Park. It's a mountain face long considered too steep to climb, easily the world's most challenging climb. Tommy Caldwell eventually completed the first solo free climb, no assistance, of the Dawn Wall in January of 2015. After 19 days of continuous climbing along with his partner Kevin Jorgensen, these sounds simply do not do justice to the pictures of Tommy on the rock holding on like some flea and the spectacular view from Tommy's perspective on that wall. Caldwell's new book is called The Push, A Climber's Journey of Endurance, Risk, and Going Beyond Limits.
The push is what we call our final attempt on a big climb. You practice it for a lot of years and then you make a push at the end. So that's where the idea came from. But also one of the most dramatic moments of my life was actually this moment where I pushed an Islamic militant over a cliff, which is, you know, this life-changing moment, which is kind of central to the book in a lot of ways.
Oh, right. And the Islamist militants, that's just another chapter in Caldwell's story. When he was 21 and climbing in Kyrgyzstan, he was captured and held hostage by militants for 6 days until he saw a moment to push his captor off a cliff and made an 18-mile trek to safety.
The next morning, the morning after my birthday, yeah, we got shot at from, you know, we were 1,000 feet up a cliff. And we were in these hanging cots, these fabric tents high up on the wall, and the bolts were coming straight up from below, and there's no way to run away. So, I mean, it was like a coming of age moment in every way for me. You know, I was a kid, I was 21 years old and quite young for a 21-year-old going into that place. And then I came out of it thinking that I had killed somebody. I came out of it... it was such an intense experience that I'm kind of still digesting it in a lot of ways.
Caldwell is 38 now. He's got one less finger than he used to, which he decided to permanently remove after an accident because he thought it would hurt his climbing, though it didn't stop him from the Dawn Wall. He also is married and has children of his own that he takes on adventures around the world, all part of a life that he doesn't see as one of conquest, but instead one of rhythm. And a life he definitely does not want to lose.
You know, I think people love to use this word conquer in climbing, and I kind of don't like that word so much because...
The rock doesn't give.
You're not going to conquer the rock. You're not going to conquer nature. It's more like this merging. It's like a dance or something. We want to become part of it. We don't want to fight against it.
And so when did you formulate the idea that this was something you were going to actually do?
that face of El Capitan is incredibly inspiring to really anybody that goes to Yosemite. Yeah. You look up there and it's just big and it's massive and it seems otherworldly. And to climbers, we go there and we're like, that looks so absurd to climb that, that the fact that people do climb it is just incredibly inspiring. So when I was a teenager, it's all I wanted to do. And then I spent 20 years of my life going there and failing and then figuring out how to climb it and going back over and over again and eventually getting to the point where I was climbing the aspects of it that nobody else really thought could be climbed. And that was a cool place to be. Like all of a sudden I was like Shagger, you know, I was like one of these adventurers. I was exploring something. I was like, I have to seize this.
What are the fails like when you're trying for that long to achieve something?
Yeah, I mean, I think the way I've formatted my life is that I fail 95% of the time. So I'm kind of used to it. It's like I pick these goals and I don't reach them most of the time. And you start to realize that those goals, all they are focal points. Really, it's that life of pursuit that is the richness. And that's what I'm in it for.
And there's rock climbing and there's recreational rock climbing. And then there's, you know, where you push yourself the way you're talking about. What distinguishes the very best climbers from people who just are weekend rock climbers who are pushing themselves, to be sure, but there's a very, very high altitude, small group of people who do what you do?
Yeah. Oh, man, that's a... What distinguishes them? If I have to boil it down, I think it's people that are genuinely inspired and motivated for kind of these personal growth reasons rather than how they're going to be seen by others. I think it has to, it's such a personal thing, you know?
So you're trying to convince me that it's actually a form of sanity, not insanity, to do what you do.
Yeah, no, I think, yeah, I mean, as I'm digesting that comment, I think that's very accurate. I never, just like I don't like the word thrill seeker or the word conquer, I don't really like the word insane either. That's not why we're doing it.
You're not reckless.
That's arguable. Okay. I definitely have been reckless at times in my life. But it's almost like you have to, like, wrestle with that reckless nature to... figure out how to, yeah, I don't know, climbing is like this. It's like negotiating the minefield on a daily basis, and you eventually figure out a way to safely make it through.
There's so much talk about climate change and the fact that the Earth is changing and that the forests and the primordial landscapes and ecosystems have been so altered by human beings. The rocks are special. How do you view that?
You know, I am out. You know, I spend the majority of my life in these very high mountain environments. I'm walking on the glaciers that are receding every year. The rocks are actually falling apart because
really?
Of, yeah,
so
and a lot of places
too.
Places like the Alps. You know, these mountains are used to being frozen together, and as all that ice melts, the rocks start to fall apart. And so, I think we experience the effects of the changing climate.
So we think of rocks as permanent, but in fact they're not.
They're more permanent than glaciers, I suppose, but they are affected. Everything's affected, and you understand how intertwined everything is.
How is what you do different from climbing Mount Everest and all the controversy that's associated with the Everest climbs and the disasters that have happened up there? And
You know, Everest is this interesting thing because it's the highest, it's really this ego-driven place. Like people come there and they, you know, in great masses just to put a check mark in the box, basically, to say that I've climbed Mount Everest. Most people, at least until recently, had no idea what big wall free climbing is. You know, it's not really an ego-driven thing. So it's – well, no, I'll take that back. It is an ego-driven thing. Everything's an ego-driven thing. But I feel in my biased opinion that it's a bit more pure, I suppose.
So your dad passed the torch to you, right?
Mm-hmm.
You got any plans to encourage some – little shaver to on the moon or something?
I've got two kids of my own. I got a 4-year-old son, Fitz, and a 1-year-old daughter, Ingrid, and we just returned from a 2-month climbing trip in Europe. with them. So I want to live in that example that my dad showed me, but I might want to tone it back just a little bit, because the one thing about going outside and experiencing the adventurous things, like when I was really young, my dad was like taking me out in storms and we were sleeping in snow caves when I was like 3.
Oh, get out.
Yeah, and it changed my idea of risk a little bit. Like I became somewhat reckless just because I was so used to it. So with my own kids, I want them to be enriched by nature, and I want them to understand adventure, but I maybe want them to tone it back just a little bit, you know?
Tommy Caldwell, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Tommy Caldwell, rock climber and the author of The Push, A Climber's Journey of Endurance, Risk, and Going Beyond Limits. More stories, Tommy, more stories. Have you pushed your personal limits to achieve something?
This is Micah from Glasgow, Kentucky. Although I am terribly afraid of flying, I jumped out of a perfectly good plane. I did it in honor of my dad, who was fighting sinus cancer and was undergoing chemotherapy and radiation to his head. And I thought, if that man can go into a machine every day and have radiation strike his left temple, then I can jump out of a plane and try to combat my fear of flying.
Thank you, Micah. We want more of your stories. Everyone's invited to call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Find us on Twitter or Facebook. Thanks, as always, for joining us today. Until tomorrow, I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, working to help people reclaim between 5 and 30 minutes a day to learn something new and build their CQ, or Curious Quotient, through the game of lifelong learning. More at Curious.com/PRI. By Staples. Staples offers copy and print services for businesses, including color copies, presentations, and promotional products. More at Staples stores or at Staples.com. Staples, it's pro time. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.